No risk it, no biscuit.
Arizona Cardinals fans, do you see red? Are you part of the Red Sea? Then you are listening to the show for you, a podcast for Cardinals fans, by Cardinals fans, with outsider and insider perspectives. It's time to rise up and see red. Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast. It's been a while. Sorry, guys, but, you know, there hasn't much going on. I'm your host, Jess Root, from CardsWire.com, the USA Today NFL Wire site, covering the Arizona Cardinals. Co-host, as always, Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, SB Nation's Arizona Cardinals site, and also the host for the NFL Draft Breakdown podcast. Seth, how's everything going? It's been a while. I mean, we haven't had a show since right after the draft, so it feels like forever, actually.
Yeah, it's been busy despite the break for us. Real life keeps us both very busy, and but there's been, you know, some manufactured, as we talked about, manufactured yes. Arizona Cardinals news that we find a way to cover every day, and still really enjoy it. So that's, you know, that's the fun part, is that we do still enjoy it, even if it is slightly manufactured. but you know what? It's still fun.
Now, the two of us, both Seth and I, have been busy with family and other stuff going on. Obviously, after the draft, we had our show at the beginning of May. The school year finished, so we had, you know, he had school to finish in his semester, and my kids had school. Then after that, we've been out and about. Seth actually has had, you know, he was living bachelor life for a while. His family came to visit, and I've been, you know, had a trip to Spain that was fantastic. And unfortunately for that, that meant I didn't get to see any of OTAs. I still listened to everything that happened. I still got the press conferences via live streaming. But the one thing I didn't know, because I was traveling with my daughter, was not in person for those workouts. And so then I spent last week in a terrible place called Tucson for the other job. And so now we're back. We're back, and we've got a bunch of – yes, pretty much. We've got a bunch of stuff that we can talk about, dating back to the OTAs and also mini camp, as we're about 3 weeks to a month away from the start of training camp, which will start up. They're actually starting a little bit later than they can because of the Hall of Fame game. But it's really going to be fun when that comp rolls around. But we're going to be talking about some of the off-season stories that came out of OTAs, namely Carson Palmer and his rest. We're going to talk about the injuries that they suffered and what that means for someone like Dion Buchanan, Hassan Reddick, the quarterback job and how that's shaping up right now. And everybody's favorite quarterback, we're going to talk about Blaine Gabbert. And some of the interesting optimism that seems to be being pushed out there by some high-end Cardinals executives. We just finished up the NFL Network's top 100 players of the NFL for 2017. We'll look at who the Cardinals were. These are things we already know about, but we'll discuss whether there should have been more and whatnot and so forth and all of that. And then just kind of one last thing is as we get closer to training camp, we'll talk about some of the players whose contracts are worth paying attention to, not necessarily for salary cap reasons this year, but because of the financial implications moving forward and decisions with personnel. So that's coming up. That's coming up now as we start the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast. And so let's start with the story of Carson Palmer. As this offseason has been one of, and we've discussed this briefly, I think in our last, if I recall, I think we talked about it in the post-draft thing. Carson Palmer didn't do a whole lot of work. He sat out, didn't throw as nearly as much, or make sound like he didn't throw at all during February and March. He has only did some soft toss, long toss for the first part of OTAs, a couple of practice, and then worked in mini camp. So we've got arrested Carson Palmer. When you ran across that story, what were your impressions about the decision to do it?
I mean, I thought it made sense from the aspect of, we already know he's got arm issues, in the sense of that he had the nerve issue where he literally couldn't feel his, you know, fingers or hand or whatever the issue was. It was basically dead arm. And he's going to be 38 this year. So you know what you have in Carson Palmer. You don't need to find out, you know, any of the intricacies of the offense. This is year five. Chad Williams is really the only guy you're working in, and how much is he going to play? Hopefully not much if, you know, Brown and Brown are back and healthy. So it made sense. And then it made sense from the other aspect of they had, what, 19 quarterbacks in rookie and mini camps.
They did have, what was it?
Six
quarterbacks this year. Five. Yeah, because they had Palmer, Stanton, Blaine Gabbert, Trevor Knight, and then
Zach Dysart for a while.
Whatever. Oh, yeah, they had Zach Dysart and then Pipkin, right?
Yeah,
Pipkin. He was there briefly before.
So,
but I mean, he didn't make it past rookie camp, so geez.
Right. So it made sense. I mean, like, let these guys figure out what they can do, what they can't do. I mean, quite honestly, I wouldn't have let Drew Stanton out there either. Like, we know who Drew Stanton is at this point. You know, I've seen people still side with Stanton. I've seen a lot of people not side with Stanton. I mean, but basically Stanton's a really good backup in the NFL. He's a guy that you're going to keep around. He's, you know, made millions of dollars to throw minimal amount of passes. And
as a starter for the Cardinals, don't forget, he's got one of the best winning percentages I've ever had. One of, I think three quarterbacks who are above 500 as starters and have had more than five starts. Stanton's one of them at 6-3. So there's Palmer, who's by far got the best winning percentage of any quarterback ever. I got Stanton at 6-3, and I believe Jay Schrader was 5-4. I mean, there's some stats for you.
And you know,
Stanton's been one of the best starting quarterbacks.
Right, and it's one of those things where you just look at it, and we know Arians trust him, and like we're seeing with Blaine Gabbert right now, you know, if Arians likes a guy, he's going to give him every opportunity to not succeed, and I think, you know, we're seeing that with Blaine Gabbert playing out, as we'll talk about a little bit later, but we already seen that with Drew Stanton. It's a trust factor. It's a you know, comfort level factor, and it's just, I don't, you know, you and I have talked about it. I don't think Stanton's going anywhere this year. And quite frankly, I don't know if, you know, God forbid Carson Palmer hangs him up, I don't really know if he's going anywhere next year, or if the Cardinals would keep Stanton around and kind of have a Blaine Gabbert, Drew Stanton quarterback battle off for a while. So it, you know, it's just
oh no. you remember John Skelton, Kevin Cobb.
Right. So I mean, we
Drew Stanton, Blaine Gabbert, my gosh, that type of stories all the off season. But people would read.
Yeah.
People would read it. So yes, we welcome that. Yes. Stanton and Gabbert and a rookie. Stanton,
exactly.
Gabbert, rookie. Perfect. Perfect scenario. Oh.
And, you know, but do you know, and, you know, we've written about the Cardinals for long enough. So, but you know what we haven't got this offseason, and we're used to it, but because of the Blaine Gabbert appearance, we haven't had to deal with the Trevor Knight quarterback of the future talk, which is an offseason ritual, undrafted free agent quarterback of the future. So we had 2 years ago, Phillip Sims, and then last year, Jake Coker, and then, you know, now we would have Trevor Knight, but we're basically have an undrafted free agent in Blaine Gabbert filling that role for this offseason. So
yes, and for me, the Palmer decision was interesting because it flies in the face of football tradition. You need the reps, you need the reps, you need the reps, you need the reps. And we see guys like Tom Brady, who even plays in a fourth preseason game last year. Why did he say? Because he needed the reps. Because, you know, they gave Jimmy Garoppolo enough reps during the first games because of the suspension. Carson Palmer's a workaholic and in a practice. I mean, he loves football and he loves working on his craft. And so telling him to not throw really flies in the face of everything he believes as a football player. We'll see if it works, because it did pay dividends at the end of last year when they started sitting him on Wednesdays. And it sounds that, and getting the impression that entering this offseason, it was having Palmer rest was a twofold plan. One, to keep his arm fresh, it's not like he wasn't doing anything with his arm. I said this on one of the other shows a year ago, that I think, you know, he was so good in 2015, but he was also very focused in rehabbing both his knee and his shoulder entering 2015. So he was on a roll. 2016, he didn't have the injuries to recover from, and so it was a little different regimen. If he were put back on the shoulder regimen that he was working on before 2015, which I think would be wise with the shoulder strength and everything like that, ideally what that will do is put him in a position of how sharp he was to start 2015, and kind of set him in the right direction for this coming season, because the first half of the season, we could tell there was lots of reasons. The protection was bad. The receivers were bad. And the throws were just a little, they weren't perfect like they were the year before. So in part, it was to give him rest because they saw his performance improves dramatically in the second half of the season. He looked like the 2015 version of Palmer for much of the second half of the season in terms of performance. And I think all along they intended on acquiring some new quarterback, either via the draft or, in this case, it became Blaine Gabbert, to give them enough reps in the offseason to develop them. And that will continue to be the case all through the season. On Wednesdays, Bruce Arians said it about the rookie. If there was a rookie who came in, it'd be a perfect situation because Carson Palmer's going to sit Wednesdays, and that rookie would get Wednesday reps. And I'm guessing that will be the case this year for whether that's Gabbert or not. But it's an interesting type of thing because we normally don't see that from football players, especially in the off season. The quarterbacks get their reps and they want to work on their timing and their chemistry. And so we'll see if it works out, and it sounds almost brilliant. But it's just, we haven't heard of this from other aging quarterbacks, Kurt Warner, Brett Favre, Tom Brady. They seem to have done all the offseason reps as well. So it'll be interesting to take that looking forward.
It will. Now, and, you know, I think the Gabbert thing in the off season or the regular season is going to be big because, again, they know what they have in Stanton. And the question now is, will it be better than Gabbert? And if it's not, then I think you can, you know, I think you know that he'll be gone, but everything we've heard, and you know, it is off season kind of propaganda ish, but everything we've heard is he's gonna, you know, be here and they like him and they see him as a long term type thing. And I don't know. So I think all of that makes sense to go with what you're talking about, that they're gonna play or they're gonna have him in the kind of rest role running that first offense with Stanton in the off season or in the regular season on those Wednesdays off.
The next part of the off season stories is that of the injury situation. AQ Shipley was out during OTAs and minicamp. It doesn't seem to be something to terribly worry about. He'll be back for training camp, but it allowed Cole Toner Not Evan Bain, mind you. Cole Toner was the one taking the snaps as a first team center, a position he's been working on the offseason, leaving Evan Bain to get those reps at right guard. But the main injury that is of perhaps concern, this is the what you wanted to talk about in particular, is that injury to Deion Buchanan, who had offseason ankle surgery. Apparently it didn't heal early the way they thought, because it sounded like it right after the season that everything was fine, and then they decided to have ankle surgery. He might miss the start of the season, so he might not be ready, or even if he's active, he could be in a situation where he's not quite ready to play, which puts Hassan Reddick in his position, first round pick, a guy learning a new position. And the talk, I mean, of course, the off-season propaganda that they like to say, but Reddick has been really good. He's been smart, but at the same time, by all accounts, other than the one comment Arian said about being, you know, it's a classic Wally Pipp, it seemed in other conversations and with other reporters, it seems very clear that Deion will jump right back in when it is time, and then that will push Reddick back into the specialized role that they had in mind for him initially this year, which is, you know, pass rusher, coverage guy. I got a guy who comes in for passing downs, probably.
And I thought it was interesting, and I don't know if you wrote about it. I didn't write about it. Maybe I will tomorrow. It's an older tweet. But did you see that pass rushing productivity tweet from Pro Football Focus on Reddick?
And no, I didn't.
It was kind of ambiguous on the intent, because I think they understand the idea that, like, okay, he's going to play more off ball. He's not going to be a pass rusher, but it talked about his pass rushing productivity. And so I thought that was interesting, because it's kind of what we've talked about before. We didn't see the DJ Humphreys red shirt coming, and we were very hopeful that this wasn't going to be a Robert Kimdiche kind of where he played himself into the doghouse situation. But I thought that was an interesting tweet when you combine with kind of all the moves that they've made this offseason, you know, letting Calais walk and letting Alex Okafor go and bringing in Jarvis Jones, who hasn't really been a good pass rusher. When you look at that NASCAR package, you know, would they slide a Marcus Golden or Chandler Jones inside almost and let Reddick be kind of an edge rusher? If Kimdiche is living up to his expectations, the idea behind a front four of, you know, like a Reddick, a Golden, Kimdiche, and a Jones, and basically three of those guys you can move around to play anywhere. And then Reddick, right now, you'd probably want him on the outside. Obviously, you can have him as an off-ball blitz as well, but you wonder if that's the initial plan with him when Deion gets back, and you kind of hope it is, because no matter how great he looks right now, it's, you know, a lot of half speed, node speed type stuff. And when the rubber meets the road, you still have a guy that's transitioning positions in, you know, a pretty physical division. Luckily, they open up against the Lions and the Colts, where they'll just throw the ball 9,000 times. So maybe it won't be a worry early on. But I did think that tweet was kind of interesting, because it could spell out how we see Reddick utilized in year one, if and when Buchanan gets back healthy and in the lineup. I think the biggest detriment with the Buchanan thing is this. How soon is he going to be, like, game shape ready? You know, because they're saying, oh, he could miss the start of the season. So if he's going to miss all of training camp, and that seems like a foregone conclusion at this point, I mean, how soon are we going to hear or see him back in the lineup in shape and ready to contribute?
That's an important question. And I thought I just had now is – I wonder if they were ready to let his ankle heal, but then decided with the after having drafted Reddick to say, all right, go ahead and get the surgery. We really like Reddick, and we think he needs the reps at the new position, and I think we can with he and Dansby, and we can probably roll with him at least a game or two to start the season and be okay, with the purpose being to make sure that Deon's ankle is actually 100%, because we've seen how incredibly dynamic he is when he's 100% healthy in 2015. And last year, I mean, 100 tackles according to what the team kept, but he wasn't nearly as dynamic, except we saw strides in coverage.
Right, and that was important. And that's why I think, again, with Reddick, you're going to see his role be more involved as a pass rusher early on, maybe a blitzing linebacker or a pseudo pass rusher, as opposed to a traditional off-ball linebacker. And so I hope that it doesn't delay that progress or play at all, with the injury to Deon.
And well, I think that's the one thing though with Reddick, he's done the pass rushing thing before. So as long as he's getting the terminology, that's a skill he knows how to do. It's the in space stuff that he's learned how to learn. The other big thing, really, that big takeaway from offseason workouts is while the practices aren't reportable per se, everything that what everyone is saying between players and coaches is that, remember the whole question about the second quarterback? It looks like it's going to be exactly as we thought it would be, and that is Justin Bethel taking hold of the job and separating himself from Brandon Williams and from Eli Buka and really the rest of the group. And, after they didn't really draft a cornerback and they didn't sign anyone free agency, one of our shows before, I asked Cardinals fans, I think I tweeted this too, how comfortable are you in a Brandon Williams versus Patrick versus Justin Bethel position battle? And it elicited groans and concerns from the fan base, when that was probably the plan all along. Barring a stud cornerback early on that they really liked becoming available, as long as Bethel's healthy, and hopefully he can, it looks like he's going to be the starter.
And that, that begets the question. I've asked it, and the responses were interesting. If Bethel really does step into that number two role, did the Cardinals make a mistake in allowing him to shorten his contract? And the responses were, that'll just give Brandon Williams one more year to mature and everything. But the question is more, what do you want to continue to have that revolving door at cornerback too? And then if he is good, do you want to pay him, what are we looking, probably $6 to $8 million a year? Because he's only going to be 27. So you're probably looking, $4.24 million, maybe. I mean, with his special teams play, you might be looking $5.30 million, with 15 guaranteed. And I don't know, like that. That's my question is, if he plays well, it's definitely a gamble on himself Bethel took, but if he plays well, was it a mistake by the Cardinals to allow that and then have to play this roulette of cornerback two again?
And I like the decision that Bethel made, because it showed that he knows he can do it. And he's been unequivocal about the last two seasons. He says, I can do it. I know what I can do. I deserve to be a starter. I can start in this league. And he's like, it was my foot. I couldn't physically do some of the things I needed to do. And unfortunately for him, for the perspective from the fans, when he was out there late in 2015 getting beaten, it was because he was sucking it up for the team because they needed him. And then last year as well. But
right, and I get it from his point of view. I'm looking at it from more of the Cardinals' point of view. It's like, oh man, is this going to be a mistake? Like,
well, they had to because the other decision was they needed the cap space. What were they going to do? Cut him?
Yeah,
when he was their best option this year.
We know they're not.
That ended up being the issue. Is that
Tyvon Branch for some reason still so.
Well, yeah, and so, you know, they had to be willing to do it because they approached us and said, hey, we want to pay you less this year. Would you take a pay cut? And he's like, okay, if I can end my contract after this year, what were they going to say? No one cut him? Because as we've seen, and I think they knew all along, he was going to be their starter. And as much as they're comfortable with Brandon Williams, he's still raw. I mean, he's a competitor, but Bethel, I mean, they've talked about it for years in terms of cover talent. He has the ability, the talent, the potential to be a very good corner if he can, you know, get past his own head and keep his confidence level high. So, I mean, really, they had no other choice but to do that. Either just eat the money this year, or which they really didn't have the cap space to do, or cut him, and then you'd be left without your best second cornerback on the team.
Right, and you didn't want to go into this year with the Brandon Williams, Eli Buka, duo, and you didn't want to force a cornerback selection in the draft again, which we saw in 2016. And, you know, it's not an indictment of Brandon Williams or what he might become, but it was definitely for year one. And, you know, if he's not a contributor, and probably 50% of the defensive snaps in year two, it was probably a reach in the third round. Now maybe he starts in 2018 and everything's hunky-dory, but, you know, in year one and two, I think everybody would probably agree it looks like a reach right now, and you don't want to have that as, you know, kind of hanging over your head. And for Brandon Williams, you don't necessarily want the pressure either. So we'll see what happens. But you're right. I like the ability this gives them, because now you have Bethel, who's, you know, your quote unquote veteran presence over there. And then you have two young guys. I'm really interested to see what Buka has to offer, because Emory Hunt, of footballgameplan.com, who's a guy that actually watches these guys that, you know, you and I have never heard of until they end up on the Cardinals team. He's raved about what Buka was athletically. And I know one of the things that Justin and I talk about on the Draft Breakdown podcast ad nauseum is, do you want athletic players that have had leg injuries? And so that is kind of what Buka is now. The difference being, it didn't cost you a draft pick. So you're able to, you know, kind of, it's a gamble without actually taking a gamble, so to speak. So we'll see.
Exactly.
We'll see what Buka has. So I'm excited about the prospects of that second cornerback position. I just worry if the landing's going to get stuck this year, or if we're going to be in a situation where, you know, they're looking at a Brandon Flowers, you know, in week one to come in and kind of be a veteran, because it's not working out.
Yeah. Well, that'll wrap up this segment of the show. These are the biggest stories in terms of what happened during OTAs, and so we're going to come back and talk about, actually, which is I wanted to keep separate because it's worth talking a lot about, and that is Blaine Gabbert. That's coming up next on Rise Up, C-Red. We're back on Rise Up Sea Red, and it's time to talk about everybody's favorite new quarterback, and that would be Blaine Gabbert. Cardinals signed him about a week ago, and leaving a lot of Cardinals fans to question why. And you look at it, you have to wonder, based on his past performance, what in the world are they thinking? Now, as we've discussed, it's a minimum contract. I mean, if he's going to be your third quarterback, who would you rather have on the roster, Blaine Gabbert or Zach Dysart, or Blaine Gabbert or Trevor Knight, Blaine Gabbert? Every single time, Blaine Gabbert is the better talent. He has starting experience. There's something there in terms of potential, while Dysart, who's yet to take an NFL snap despite being in the league since 2013, like, try to look up a stat. You'll never find one. He doesn't have any. And, you know, Trevor Knight, who was just awful as a quarterback in terms of accuracy a season ago. And yeah, one of your writers, Blake Murphy, even, you know, put out there that he would be better suited as a receiver athletically based on the testing that he did. So Blaine Gabbert. And here's the thing. And let me, you know, I'll have you tell me, but what your impressions are, that this is opinion of the player or not, the impression that we're getting from every Cardinals person involved is this: Gabbert might be the future of the quarterback position for the team. Harold Goodwin, offensive coordinator at a charity function, talked about how he spoke with Gabbert, and he said, you know, look at these tools. They talk about the weapons he has, the Larry Fitzgerald and the receivers, John Brown, and take a look at he's learning the offense, and he gets to see the tools that he has for the future. And I said, wait, he just used the word future and Blaine Gabbert together. Michael Bidwill has, on multiple occasions, especially recently when he's been doing his campaign promoting the London games while in London, he feels like Blaine Gabbert might be the next Kurt Warner and Carson Palmer. Now, he does qualify it, but, you know, he talks about, we've had the success with, you know, guys that have been cast off that people think are done, Kurt Warner, Carson Palmer, and it talks about the guy that we signed after the draft. They think, I mean, this, it's very obvious that the team is very intrigued by him as a talent. And here's the thing. He does fit the Arians mold. Now, has Arians ever taken a no-talent quarterback and raised him up? We've never seen it. We've never seen that. He's, you know, but who's he had success with? Tim Couch, Peyton Manning, Ben Roethlisberger, Andrew Luck, Carson Palmer. There's something of all of these players that are in common. One, size. Two, arm strength. And then here's the other one. When they came out, they were considered near the top of the talent at the position. Gabbert still fits that, even though he hasn't had the performance, which leaves, there's a lot of intrigue in terms of, wait, this might be Arian's greatest accomplishment ever if he does this. And so I'm left, wait, could he? I mean, there's a mold that he's had success with, and Gabbert fits it. Could he fix him? Or if maybe Gabbert's not really broken, he just hasn't been in the right situation. And your take, I'm ready for this, because you're not nearly as high on him as maybe I or a lot of Cardinals fans are.
Well, here's the thing, right? Like, I get everything from the negative, or the, I don't know what you want to call it, the positive, negative side, whatever, that he's had, you know, seven head coaches and offensive coordinators and 7 years in the NFL. You know, he was picked highly for a reason, all of that good stuff. But one of the things that continually comes to me every time, you know, you want to get excited, and I have a lot of buddies on Twitter that are Jags fans. I think I just like to surround myself with misery. Maybe that's what it is. So, but, you know, I have a lot of buddies that are Jags fans on Twitter. And if you go back and you look at their Vines or their, you know, their Twitter videos or any of their, you know, stuff on Gabbert, it's just painful to watch. And it's not the ineptitude of, oh, what are, you know, it's not the Carson Palmer plays where you're like, oh, how can you throw that backbreaking interception? It's not even the Blake Bortles types of plays where you're like, what, you know, what are you doing, you know, trying to make that throw? It's plays where you see him throw the ball backwards.
How are you in this league?
Yeah.
You're like, how are you even in this league?
Throw the ball backwards. You know, you see him, you see him take a sack when there's a clear running lane. It just seemed like awareness and situational awareness and things like that was never part of it. And that's always the concern with me is you can teach a lot of things for quarterbacks, but what you can't teach is how to win in a crowded pocket. You can't teach players how to win. You know, we make fun of Carson Palmer because he can't move that well, but he is one of those guys that is fearless and will take chances and make throws from in the pocket that you're like, oh my God. And then, you know, sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, but he still stands there and makes a throw. Whereas Gabbert's one of those guys, if you watch his eyes, go back and watch his work with the 49ers, and I know they sucked. Go back and watch his work with the Jaguars, and I know they sucked. But his eyes always are looking at what's happening right in front of them and not down the field. And I just, from a perspective of evaluation, not anything else, I just don't know if that's coachable. I really don't. And it's because you don't see it at any level where guys get away with it. You know, if you're an athlete in Pop Warner or high school football or even college football, you can get away with it because you're a superior athlete to everybody else on the field. But in the NFL, you're, as a quarterback, you're usually, you know, the 10th best, 11th best athlete on your offense. And so you have to be able to win from the pocket, especially when it's collapsing around you. And I just haven't seen that from Blaine Gabbert. One of the things you read about and you go back and maybe I'll do that. And maybe I'll go back and read about all the positive offseason Blaine Gabbert or write about all the positive offseason Blaine Gabbert hypes that we've seen before. And the question becomes, why is this different? Now, is this different because we're Cardinals fans, or is this different because he has a very competent coaching staff around him? Could it be a mixture of the two things? And then finally, is it Blaine Gabbert going to be the Kurt Warner, Carson Palmer, who both had success before they came to Arizona? Let's not, you know, overlook
right. that. That's the big difference. Kurt Warner was an MVP. Carson Palmer
was an MVP candidate a couple of times.
He was.
You know, Pro Bowl quarterback. You know, or is he, you know, I've said this. I think personally, I think he can be a competent backup quarterback in the NFL. You know, he's been in what? I think this will be his 7th year. So,
yeah.
He'll, you know, can he play another 5, 6, 7 years as a backup? Absolutely. Can he be a starter in the NFL? That's honestly the million-dollar question. And that's what matters to the Cardinals. And you know, if he becomes a competent backup and is a guy that can be on this roster for the next 5 to 10 years, that's fantastic. But it doesn't necessarily do anything for the Cardinals right now, because all they're doing is exchanging Drew Stanton for Blaine Gabbert. So I you know, that's my take on the Gabbert situation. I probably could be a lot more harsh, but I'm trying to let this play out itself as opposed to letting, you know, what has actually happened before be the precursor. I guess the only player that I can think of off the top of my head, and maybe you can think of one that has had sustained success after a pretty abysmal start to his career. And it wasn't even that bad now that I look at it, would be Rich Gannon. You know, the former Raiders quarterback who was in the NFL from 1987. I don't know how many of you listeners out there knew that, but you know, the guy that led the 2000, you know, Raiders renaissance was in the NFL from 1987. So at 35, you know, Gannon became, or 34, Gannon became a Pro Bowler, two-time first team All-Pro as a 35 and 37-year-old, you know, obviously led the Raiders to a Super Bowl where they lost. But you look at all of that, he was still a quarterback that, you know, went 19-16 in Minnesota, went 11-8 in Kansas City. His one stop where he was unsuccessful, he was 1-3 in Washington. That, I mean, that's like, I'm trying to think of anybody else that can kind of follow in
Gabbert. Steve Berline is a guy that the Cardinals fans might recognize if you've been around the Cardinals long enough. He was basically a career backup. He was back behind Jay Schrader in Los Angeles, the Raiders. He came to the Cardinals, looked promising, Pro Bowler with Carolina later on. He did not have the same level of bad as Gabbert, but in my mind, I see a little bit of Alex Smith. Alex Smith, number one pick, his very first year, he looked like a garbage fire, a dumpster fire. He was, you know, started 7 games. He threw 1 touchdown and 11 picks as a rookie. But in year 2, he showed promise. 16 touchdowns, 16 interceptions. You know, he had a rating, you know, not a good rating, but a rating of 74.8. In 2007, only 7 games, 2 touchdowns, 4 interceptions. But then in 2009 is when he kind of started getting, it was year 4. Gabbert's been in the league 6 years, and there's been some moments, but there hasn't been any sustained success.
Right.
And that's the thing, but.
And his best year came in, you know, 15 with the 49ers, and I can't. Was that the Jim Tomsula 49ers?
Let me see. 15 would have been. That was Harbaugh's last year. No, that was Tomsula. You're right. That was Tomsula.
Yeah. So that was Tomsula, and that was his best, you know, year as a player. 10 touchdowns, 7 interceptions. 63% completion percentage, which is a nice completion percentage. The one thing I'll give Gabbert is this. Outside of his 2013 season with the Jacksonville Jaguars, which may have been the worst statistical season for a quarterback that played 3 games ever in the history of the NFL.
Brian Lindley might argue with you.
But, you know, he's been pretty consistent in not throwing a ton of picks. He threw too many last year. You know, you might say, oh, he only threw 6. Well, he only had 5 touchdowns. You know, but 13 was really the apex of terribleness for Gabbert with 7 interceptions in 3 games. So, you know, I guess that's one thing. But then the question becomes, can he be a guy that, you know, flourishes in Bruce Arians' offense? His best, you know, yards per average for a season is 7.2, which is considered bad for Bruce Arians' quarterback. So, I mean, there's all these questions. Is best QBR, you know, was last year, which is hard to believe.
Then it got him benched.
Yeah. So that's, you know, that's the question is, you know, that's the question we talk about, you know, off the air is Gabbert a product of being on a lot of really bad teams, or is he a product of he's just not very good. And then what does the Bruce Arians, Tom Moore, Arizona Cardinals affect, you know, come into play? And does it come into play? And, I wish there was a way to, you know, like we talked about, Warner and Palmer had success. They fell down, but they got back up. Gabbert's never been successful, and that's what my question/concern is.
Now, there is, and in terms of what his role for this year, there is one writer who believes that there is an actual quarterback battle between Stanton and Gabbert. There's one writer who's been talking about that multiple times in some stories that he's written. I think Gabbert is only competing with himself to not be terrible so that they can keep him on the roster as QB3. I think when they signed him, the intent was always to keep him as QB3, period. So he's just got to be not awful when it comes to, he has to show a little bit of a promise. I don't think there's any scenario in which he replaces Drew Stanton as the backup, because this team is still in a win now mode. And they know Drew Stanton can win with Drew Stanton. They don't know that about Blaine Gabbert, and I don't think they want to try that this year with the way they're set up as a team. So I will contest that theory that he's potentially going to replace Drew Stanton. He's not. He's basically just show enough promise so they keep him on the roster, so he runs the offense every Wednesday to see if they can keep him beyond 2017, at least as a backup, to replace Drew Stanton and perhaps to be their starter.
Yeah, and I'm looking. I wanted to see if I could find anybody that's been that bad before. But I can't. So, yeah, and I'm with you. I really don't think there's anything on this competition. I think Drew Stanton is the backup moving forward. The question becomes what do they have in Gabbert? And that's, you know, that's all that we're going to try to find out and hope that it works out. So
let's move on to the next segment coming next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're going to move to some of the, you know, the off-season stuff. So not so much stories, but things that we've sort of fabricated around the league. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red, the top 100. We're back on Rise Up Sea Red. We're going to talk about the NFL top 100, that lovely filler for the dead of the off-season that the NFL Network does. The final results are out. The 100 best players of the NFL. Now, in terms of the methodology, it's voted on by players. Not all players vote. And the NFL Network, NFL people go around and give a sampling of players a list that they give their top 20 players. And based on that, you get your top 100. Now, who was on the Cardinals? There were four, ranging from the highest level at number 12 was David Johnson, down to number 80-something. Can't remember exactly what number that is. Let me pull that up. 85, Chandler Jones. And we can even get a little bonus in there as number 83. We can add a fifth Cardinal because it was based on his years at Cardinal, be Calais Campbell, now on the Jacksonville Jaguars. First, do you think that there are any players on the Cardinals that should have been in the top 100 who were not?
No, I'm trying to think. No, probably not. I mean, you could make a case. You could make a case for Carson Palmer, but it's such a fickle thing anyways, but no, I wouldn't say there was.
And for me, I would make the case for two Cardinals. One would be Carson Palmer and the other would be Marcus Golden. However, I understand reputation goes with them. Marcus Golden had a fantastic season, but coming into the NFL, he was known as a number two rusher who benefited from the likes of a Shane Ray at Missouri, a dominant pass rusher. Golden recently comes up on some lists, so you wrote about it, I wrote about it, on the league's Most Unblockable, that he has not only relying on his intense motor, he is also improving. So he, on this top 10 list of the most 10 unblockable edge rushers, he ranks ahead of Vic Beasley, the league sack leader, and Chandler Jones, who's not even listed. Even though the feeling is that Chandler Jones made everything happen. And 12 and a half sacks on the season, very dominant year. Marcus Golden, probably based on the people in there. Now, it's not like, who are you going to put him all over there? Lorenzo Alexander, who had a tremendous year, is, you know, 91. So you've got, do you put Marcus Golden in then there over Joey Bosa? I mean, Bosa's a young talent, so that's perhaps someone you're like, oh, he should be in there over Bosa, but Bosa's got the first round top five pedigree. Carson Palmer, though, a year ago, he was number 12. Number 12. He wasn't in the top 100 before, went to number 12 after his incredible season, and then fell off again. But let's look at the quarterbacks that are at the back end of the 100. So you've got Alex Smith. Now, question, would you rather have Carson? Who's better, Carson Palmer or Alex Smith? What do you think?
Well, I'd rather have Carson Palmer because at least you get the spectrum. I know what I have in Alex Smith, so I'm not sure I'm gonna get much out of him, especially, you know, in the Arizona Cardinals offense.
What about Philip Rivers? At this point,
you know, the hard
Palmer
part...
or Rivers? I would say Palmer over Rivers right now. And now you look at a career, and that's how the players do it. They look at the season and they look at the career, because that's how Larry Fitzgerald ends up on these lists year after year after year after year.
Even well, not just had... on the list, just like, I mean, top 15. And I love Fitz, don't get me wrong, but I mean, what was he, 45? That's a lofty.
It is.
So
Kirk Cousins. Now Kirk Cousins had a great year, and he's a guy I still don't believe in, but if you look at the numbers, he is a great quarterback.
He's gonna be the highest paid quarterback in the NFL next year. Like, that's insanity to me. That's complete and utter insanity. But again, I go back to this, right? All right, so I would probably take Rivers. But that's because I think his level of consistency is better than Palmer. But with Cousins, I don't know. I'm with you. Like, I don't know if he's actually good or not. So
what about Jameis Winston, who comes in at number 57? And if you look at the year that he had, very comparable to Carson Palmer. 28 touchdowns, 18 interceptions to Carson's 26 and 14, 4,090 yards, less than completion percentage under 61%. Now, I get in part, you know, Jameis Winston also has that number one pick pedigree. It's not just what Carson Palmer is, but he's old. So I get how this works, but, you know, based on the quarterbacks we're seeing, you know, even and Winston is number 57. You could argue that Carson Palmer definitely should be on this list. I mean, not saying that he's top 20, because he shouldn't have been top 20, but top 70. He's, in my opinion, probably one of the 100 best players in the NFL, especially at playing at the position that he does.
And, you know, it's one of those things where you look at it where I guess I missed that Winston was on there. So I now understand why everybody was – or not everybody, but there was part of Twitter complaining about or that Mariota is better than Winston, because I'm assuming Mariota wasn't on this list. Then
Mariota was. In fact, Mariota was higher.
Oh, was he?
Mariota comes, yes, coming up number 50.
Oh, okay.
Number 50, Winston's 57, Andrew Luck number 51.
Really? Oh, interesting. See, I don't pay attention to these things unless it involves the Cardinals. So, yeah, I mean, from a perspective of like going forward, I would take all of those guys over Palmer, but from the perspective of, you know, this year, I don't know. Like, again, I think Winston you could take. I mean, Luck, obviously, I still think Andrew Luck's the best quarterback in the NFL. And then Mariota, I don't know if he fits this offense. So, you know, it's tough. You look at it, I would have to, you know, from this year, though, those guys are all going to get picked over Palmer because of team success. And that might seem, you know, illogical, but Palmer was on a team that was finished under 500. And I think.
And he had a huge drop off as well.
I mean, he did.
Huge drop off. That's actually unfair.
He had a huge drop off in counting stats. So we threw less touchdowns, more interceptions. And that matters when you're talking about just guys looking at things in a grand overview. But, you know, when you look at it overall, I don't know, like, is it really that much of a difference? In the end, it's going to come down to the, like it or not, quarterback wins matter. And I know there's a sect of society or football society out there that hates this idea, but I always tell the story, NFL executive that I just happened to be at a kid's soccer game with, and I asked him, you know, kind of just off cuff, like, hey, and he had no shot at either guy. I said, hey, what do you think of this, you know, Winston Mariota debate? And this was in January. And he said, Jameis Winston's never lost a start. That was his response. He didn't talk about anything else. He said, Jameis Winston's never lost a start. Now, then Jameis went on to lose the next start. So great job with that. But, you know, that was the response. And so this comes from a guy that, you know, is part of a decision-making process for an NFL franchise. And no, it's not the Arizona Cardinals. So when you look at that, it matters. And so when Carson Palmer only won six games last year because Drew Stanton won a game, that matters. And it's unfortunate, but it's the reality.
The other question along here, this is, we're going back up to the top, and that is the question of David Johnson. I thought David Johnson probably would crack the top 10. He didn't. Number 12. But not only that, he was the third highest rated running back. So he comes in number 12. Le'Veon Bell at number 9. And I'm okay with that. Here it is. Number 7, Ezekiel Elliott. Not only is Le'Veon Bell rated higher than David Johnson, and I can accept that. Ezekiel Elliott, higher than both of them. Now, he is really good. But I don't know. It's a hard, I don't know. It seems to me like the players looked at the gaudy rushing numbers instead of the player. Le'Veon Bell was the best running back at football if you look at a per-game basis. Now, he obviously didn't play the first four games, but as a per-game basis, he was the most productive player in football, and that even beats out David Johnson. David Johnson, though, he does so much more than just run the ball well. And he did it behind a not-so-good offensive line. Well, Ezekiel Elliott put up monster numbers as a rusher behind the best offensive line at the NFL. I don't have a huge problem with the rankings, but I don't love that Elliott is above and you know, five slots above a David Johnson who, now granted, we think Cardinals covering Cardinals fans, he's probably, we think that Johnson might be the best player in the NFL, best offensive player in the NFL. I get the Le'Veon Bell thing. I get it. He's done it longer. And, you know, he has the reputation. Ezekiel Elliott's only done it for a season.
But here's the thing, and this is probably a super hot take, but I think as a pure running back, just a running back, not putting together all-purpose stuff, I think Zeke is the best in the NFL. Now, I don't know many people that would argue that both Le'Veon Bell and David Johnson are better all-around players. But I can see from a perspective of the way Zeke came in and dominated the NFL from the jump. And people will say, oh, you know, what Darren McFadden had 1,000 yards. But, yeah, Darren McFadden barely cleared 1,000 yards. Zeke led the NFL in rushing. I mean, that's the difference in what happened. Now, does that make him the, you know, sixth best player in the NFL? No, but was Dak Prescott the 11th or whatever he was? No, I mean, just, he wasn't. I mean, wasn't Dak like the fourth highest quarterback?
Yeah, it was like crazy. So you've got Aaron, we've got Tom Brady, Aaron Rodgers, Matt Ryan, Derek Carr, so he's number Dak Prescott at Nemesis fifth, number 14 overall, fifth quarterback.
Okay.
So he ranks above Drew Brees.
And Russell Wilson.
And Russell Wilson, yeah. Ben Roethlisberger, you know, I mean, Ben Roethlisberger, Hall of Famer.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, we're
Drew Brees, who's got nine straight seasons of 30 touchdown passes. Guess what? There are NFL teams who haven't done that.
Right. I mean, let's just talk about that real quick. Carson Palmer has two seasons in his career of 30 touchdowns. Drew Brees has done it for nine straight, and you can say, well, look at the offense they plays in. But, I mean, the last couple years, it's not like there's been much of a difference
and then you look at it,
in attempts.
You look what offense he plays in. Why do you think the offense is so good?
Yeah.
It's Drew Brees.
So, yeah, but, I mean, when you look at it overall, again, it's a silly list, and I like that Cardinals players are on it because it shows that people see what they're doing. But it's just, you know, it's fun, and it's off-season fodder, and it gives us something to write about. It gives fans something to complain about because that's all it is. Literally, unless David Johnson's ranked number one or two, because I think begrudgingly most people will be okay with Tom Brady at the top. You know, nobody really cares because they're just going to complain about it. Like in the end, they're still going to be like, well, I can't believe, you know, Patrick Peterson was what, 19th. Oh, I can't believe Peterson was only 19th. Well, wasn't he the top cornerback or the second cornerback? Well, you know, okay. So maybe it has more to do with the position he plays as opposed to the actual, results of it. So, but that it is what it is. And I'm okay with, you know, where the Cardinals ranked. I'm glad to see, you know, five guys from a losing team, and that might sound harsh, but it's reality. I'm glad to see five guys from a losing team all made this, you know, nonsensical list and are now, you know, the Cardinals have established themselves over the first 4 years of the Keim and Arians regime as a legit NFL team. I think that's what we take away from this, is that there's not just Patrick Peterson, or there's not just Patrick Peterson and David Johnson, and we're lamenting the loss of Calais Campbell. It's that there are multiple players on both sides of the ball who garner the respect of their peers and are considered to be amongst the 100 best players in the NFL. And I think you take that away from it more than, oh, God, I can't believe Carson Palmer didn't make it. Or, oh, David Johnson's only the third best running. Like, I think in the end, that's what you have to take from it, is that players look at the Cardinals differently now. They're not, you know, to paraphrase the great Bob Kemp from Arizona, or from 1060, radio in Arizona, you know, they're not the same old sorry ass Cardinals anymore. And that's the reality. And I think that's something to be excited about, even if we don't necessarily agree with the rankings.
Right. Well, we'll wrap up this section and we're going to have one little thing to talk about. And that's, this is another fabricated thing that we're coming up with, but it's something worth looking at as the Cardinals move into the season. As we look at the future, there are several players entering a year that will be critical for their contracts. Not necessarily in terms of that, because it's not the ones who may or may not get contracts next year, but it's the importance that they play this year and what the Cardinals do moving forward. I wrote a piece about this on CardsWire. The players of the Cardinals could have contract extension issues coming up here. Because we know they're paying a lot of money to Chandler Jones. They're paying a lot of money to Tyrann Mathieu. They're paying a lot of money to Carson Palmer still, who's signed through 2018. They're paying a lot of money to Patrick Peterson. Now, but we've got players entering their third and fourth season. Recent draft picks, guys who could potentially be players who the Cardinals will want to lock up long term. The first one, obviously, is Dalen Buchanan. Is an interesting case, but they bought themselves some time. He's got the fifth year extension they've already done. But there are some players that you want to look at. Do you negotiate with them after this year, depending on how they play? If they have another really good year, do you lock them up long term, and how much is that going to cost? I've got some names: Dalen Buchanan, David Johnson, John Brown, Marcus Golden. What do you do with those guys after this season if they're all good?
The hard part is going to be the manufacturing and finding space for all these guys. So you've already paid Chandler Jones. Can you pay Marcus Golden? One thing you might be able to do, and you kind of hinted at it, is maybe you get him on a cheap deal. Like, maybe you sign him now to a 5-year, $40 million deal instead of having to wait and sign him to a 5-year, $60, $70 million deal, you know, over the summer. Maybe you can do something like that. John Brown.
Now, he's not even eligible. Like, neither Golden nor David Johnson are eligible for even talk contracts until after the season.
Right.
So that's where that comes in. Buchanan, he could now, but he's locked up through 2018. Go ahead.
And I think they want Buchanan. I don't necessarily know if Reddick was brought in just to play beside Buchanan as much as it was to ensure that the Cardinals wanted that to be their future going forward. Because when you look at a lot of different things, Buchanan didn't take the next step in 2015. Now, it might have been the injury. It could have been playing through the ankle thing. There are circumstances. Could have been the loss of that left defensive end, and the fact that, you know, whoever was playing over there didn't do as good of a job of giving him space to roam. All that being said, he didn't take the next step. In fact, in a lot of ways, he regressed slightly in 2015 outside of coverage ability. So did the Cardinals hedge for the 2018 offseason, or 2019, I guess it would be, in that now they have Buchanan, they have him on his fifth-year deal. It's going to be a cheap deal. I think it's going to be around $6 or $8 million. It's not going to be huge. And what is that going to, you know, that's going to buy them, like you said, that buys them another year. That buys them a year to figure it out with Buchanan and Reddick. And then if he plays well, you might say, well, why didn't you extend him earlier? But it also buys them, if he plays well this year, you can just extend him after this year. Whereas if he plays poorly or has another year where you're like, eh, then all of a sudden you're like, okay, well, guess who we're drafting in the third round? You know, we're gonna go find a kid like Duke Riley. We're gonna go find a kid like the like the other LSU linebacker that came out this year, or you know, Alex Anzalone from Florida. You know, we're going to go find one of these third round inside linebackers to play behind you in 2018. If you know, Buchanan's not good again in 2017, or doesn't take the next step in 2017 to hedge again for 2018. And then, you know, like you said, Golden, that's, you know, you're really hopeful that this offseason, and again, I'm talking 2018 offseason, that this offseason coming up when he's third year, that you're able to get something done for cheap, because he's going to get paid on the open market. You're not going to be able to control that cost. If you franchise him, he's going to make $16 million a year for at least 1 year. And, you know, we have another situation that we'll talk about in a second. So you're going to have to make a decision. John Brown is the interesting one because he's a free agent coming up. And, you know, after this season, he's a free agent. And he was on pace to make about $11 million a year. That was his pace before last season. Now he's got to play well. And he's going to probably get $8 million a year if he plays extraordinary. Oh, no idea what that was. Sorry. And if he plays well, he's going to get 11, you know, he'll still, or extraordinary, he's probably still going to get that $10 to $11 million a year because, again, the salary cap's going to go up again next year. The bubble's going to burst in 2021, I think it is. But that's, you know, 3 years down the road. Who's worried about that right now? So that's going to be interesting to watch, because if you're the Cardinals, do you try to sneak a 4-year, $24 million contract with John Brown and get him locked up? Because the other thing is this, he's old. I think he's 27, if I'm not mistaken. So do you really want to pay a speed guy who's going into, yeah, he's already 27, who's 27 this year. Do you really want to pay him, you know, 5 years, 50 or 60 million? Because that, if he plays really well again, that's what he's going to get. So that end of that contract, so that contract's going to look a lot like Jeremy Maclin's did for the Chiefs, where you've got a guy who's played well but never stayed healthy. Do you take a chance and say, hey, Smoke, let's offer you, let's get you locked up 6 years or 4 years, you know, $24 million. You're going to take a hit if you're good again. We're going to take a hit if you suck again. But it's a, you know, it's kind of, we're both approaching it from the same way. Or does he gamble on himself and try to get that one big contract? Because that's all he's getting. He's getting one just because of his age. He's going to get one big contract. Is he going to gamble and try to get that 5 years, you know, $55 million? And will the Cardinals be willing to pay that? The thing is, if Larry Fitzgerald comes back again or wants to play again, the Cardinals, I don't know if they can afford to be like, well, we're going to sign John Brown and not Larry Fitzgerald, you know, coming up this offseason. So that's the question. I'm very interested to see how they handle the John Brown situation, because that's the only, you know, pressing one. But the more intriguing one, and you've written about this, and I'm going to write about this in a couple weeks, is David Johnson.
Oh, David, my gosh. And Larry Fitzgerald was joking about this, and he said it very openly. He was just gushing about the amount of money the Cardinals are going to have to pay him after this year, especially if he does anything remotely like he did last year. They're going to have to basically give him all the money. And we see with Le'Veon Bell what could happen, because they didn't extend him. They waited till after, and he's franchised, and you could end up with kind of an interesting situation. My take on this is with David Johnson, if he has another good year, you have to. He's the guy, he's the Patrick Peterson he's the, you know, the Tyrann Mathieu guy that you have to get extended because, well, one, it's part of age. He's 25 this year. So after this year, well, at the end of the season, he'll be 26. You want to extend him out, give him that, give him 5 years. So it'll take him to age 31. If you wait till after year four, when he becomes a free agent, a five-year deal, which is probably what you're going to have to do, puts it out to age 32. And if you franchise him, then you potentially have some acrimonious, you know, some hard feelings, and you leave some elite years on the table as well. And then you let him go after age 27 when he could still produce at a really high level for three more years, when he's probably going to want a longer deal than that. David Johnson is a guy you've got to pay after this year because, one, he's special in terms of running backs. And I know you have a take on running backs. It's a little bit different, but I think David Johnson is one of those running backs you can't let go away, but you got to be smart about it because if he has enough, if he has a 2016 year in 2017 and 2018, he will price himself completely out and you won't be able to do anything else otherwise with the cap. So you have to pay him after this year. You have to go Patrick Peterson contract and get him, especially since you want him under contract until he gets too, you don't want him to get too old because running backs fall off a cliff.
So the salary he's looking at, just based on some quick research, is if they want to sign him, so he'll be league age 26, I think they would buy out his, not buy out, but basically.
They'd give him a big salary. It'd be a good big signing bonus probably to offset the.
Yeah. So would it be a true five-year deal or would it be like a four-year plus?
It'd be four-year extensions. I'm sure they would up the salary in 2018 as well.
So because he's going to be 26 this year. So he's going to turn 26 during the season. So, again, he's another old one. And you guys might say, oh, old, he's 26. But in respect to running backs, that's ancient. when you look at it, and you kind of talked about it with Le'Veon Bell, his is a little different, but I guess it's similar because Bell's younger, but he's got the knee issues. You know, they franchised him twice. The Cardinals are going to have to pay David Johnson 4 years, basically 5 years, and probably $55 million.
Yeah.
So it's going to cost 5 years, $55 million. That'll make him the highest paid running back in the NFL. So that number was specific on my part because he has to be the highest paid running back in the NFL. Le'Veon Bell is on a higher average, but you know, that's because he's franchised and only under a 1 year deal. Recent contract signed, 2014 or 15, Shady McCoy signed a 5 year, $40 million deal, basically $20 million guaranteed at signing. Doug Martin last year, signed a 5 year, just under $36 million, $15 million guaranteed, but they can opt out after 2017. Lamar Miller signed a 4 year, $26 million deal, so about $6.5 million a year. So that's the market. And all of those guys, by the way, signed younger outside of Doug Martin. Doug Martin is basically going to be David Johnson's kind of route to follow. So 4 years, $36 million, or sorry, 5 years, $36 million. The Cardinals, because of, like you said, David Johnson's production, it's going to be 5 years, $55 million. And the hard part is he's going to be 31 when that expires. And usage-wise, he's probably going to be done 2 years sooner. I hope I'm wrong on that, but it's just if he's healthy, his usage is going to be, you know, just through the roof. And So you know, you have to wonder and you have to look at what, you know, what does that do for the team? And when you look at it, you're going to piss them off. But when you look at it from this instance of that, you know, you give him or you franchise him, he's going to get just under $13 million. You can franchise him twice, basically, like the Steelers are doing with Le'Veon Bell. And then you got to, you know, then he's 28. He'll be 28. He'll be coming off his sixth year. The problem with that is, like you said, Fitz is gone. Palmer's gone.
He's the face of the franchise.
Right. He's the offensive face of the franchise. I'm not an advocate whatsoever of paying running backs, but I don't see a way around it. 5 years, $55 million is about what it's going to cost. When Adrian Peterson signed his big deal, I'm trying to find it. It was a little under that. Looks like it was a 5 year. I can't really find the exact amount, but it was a substantial amount. Let's just say that at the time it was, you know, he was getting paid over $8 million a year. And then he made over $11 million twice in that contract. So, and that was a 6 year deal, excuse me. So that, you know, that's something to watch. So I don't know if the Cardinals would do that much, but you know, we saw the same thing with Adrian Peterson. He's 32 now. 2015, he wasn't really good. 2014, he was good. But that was after 8 years. And he did have the knee injury. And you might say, well, that's not good. But, you know, he didn't take an NFL pounding that year, so to speak. So, you know, it's tough. Are you going to – do you really want to pay a running back 5 years, $55 million? No, but you got to do what you got to do at this point. And like you, if Carson Palmer was younger, if Larry Fitzgerald was younger, if John Brown had stepped up, you know, any of these things, I think you'd go more the Le'Veon Bell route. But because they literally have nothing on offense youth wise that we know is good outside of David Johnson. We're all hopeful about DJ Humphries. We're all hopeful John Brown comes back, but we don't know anything else. I think you look at it and, you know, like you said, you got to come to terms this offseason because another team will come and give him, you know, 5 years and $70 million and the Cardinals will watch their best offensive player go. So it's definitely a catch 22. You don't want to anger him. And I don't see David Johnson being the type that would be angered by the franchise tag, but you know, buy out that last year, 5 years, 50, $55 million. And you know, find a way to get yourself out of it after three, basically, you know, guarantee him $30 million or, you know, $35 million. And then after 3 years, have an out, pay all that up front. Don't kick the can down the road and move on from there.
The last guy to worry about, and I forgot to mention him, is DJ Humphries, which is a premium position. The one thing we run into with David Johnson is it's not a premium position. As we've learned in the NFL, you can plug and play running backs and have success. The issue is they might see him as, you know, special. And we've seen some running backs go well past 30, a few of them, and have success. But if he's facing a franchise, you can't really let him go. That's the thing. You can't let him walk. That hurts the locker room. It hurts the fan base. DJ Humphries, though, premium position at left tackle. He's entering year three. So, and it's a position that's hard to find. So is he a guy that you kick the can down the road, wait till year four, maybe franchise him year five? Never mind. He's got that fifth year option, so he'll have that fifth year. So his becomes less critical. Because you can push it back a year.
Well, but the thing is, like you look at these numbers, they're going to have to pay this dude. Like if he's good,
you pay the left tackle.
Well, not just that, but it's going to cost them. You look at it, Eric Fisher just re-signed $48 million over 4 years. David Bakhtiari out of Green Bay. All these guys, by the way, have done better than DJ Humphries. 4 years, $48 million. Russell Okung has not done better. He did, you know, he's better when he's healthy, but he's never healthy. He got 4 years, $53 million. These are all, like, in the last year. Matt Khalil has been – he got 5 years, $55.5 million. Riley Reiff is good-ish. He got 5 years, just under $59 million. Cordy Glenn, who's very good, got 5 years, $60 million. Teron Armstead from New Orleans got 5 years, $65 million. I think you get the trend. If he's good, it's going to be 12 to 14
million. 12 to 15 million. It'll be 12 to 15 if they wait too long. Because
right, and so, well, and that's what the battle becomes. You know, you look at it like the Cowboys last year signed Tyron Smith for 8 years, just under $100 million. So 8 years, $97.6 million, and they did that last year. That's what the Cardinals are looking at. And you might say, well, Tyron Smith's a Pro Bowler, you know, All Pro left tackle, right? But we're talking age, and we're talking importance of position. If he hits, if DJ Humphries becomes the player that they are hoping he is, that they would probably be better off to give him, you know, 8 years, $100 million, than kick the can down the road and have to deal with it. He's only going to be 24 this year, so you know get him next year. It, after his fourth year, if he plays two good years, you know, 8 years, you know, even if it's just 6 years, and it's just 6 years, but 6 years, you know, $70 million, that's probably where you're looking. And that's if he's, you know, good. If he's great, he'll probably become the highest paid left tackle in NFL history. That's just how important the position is. And that's what these guys get. I mean, Jason Peters is 35 years old, and he got a three-year, $33 million deal. Andrew Whitworth is 35 years old. The Chargers just gave him a three-year, $34 million contract. Like, these dudes get paid when they – even if they're just good – even when they're old, they get paid. So if you get out in front of it, like you're saying, you'll be okay. It's when you wait until they're actually good that you kind of pay the price.
Yeah. And so that'll wrap up our final wrap up the show. And we will be off next week. Family stuff, holiday stuff. I believe we will do another show in about 2 weeks, maybe three, and by then we'll be ready to preview training camp. So that wraps up today's show.
Real quick, on a happy note, I found a best case scenario for Blaine Gabbert. And so this is a happy note. Let's hope this is something that comes to fruition. Now, mind you, this is only their first 2 years because the player that had a similar rocky start to his career, that turned around, got traded, and sat behind the greatest quarterback of all time, but Steve Young. First 2 years in Tampa Bay, 3-16, 53.3 completion percentage, 11 touchdowns, 21 interceptions. If you look at their per-game statistics, they're really close to identical. Now, again, those are only the first 2 years, but I think your absolute, like, one hope that I can find on
That's
this.
That's it. Blaine Gabbert's the next Steve Young. Thank exactly. you, Seth.
You heard it here first.
Blaine Gabbert is the next Steve Young. And we will end the show there. We'll be back in 2 weeks, maybe three. That's Seth Cox. I'm Jess Root. This is Rise Up, See Red. Go Cardinals.